Good morning and welcome to Family Life. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent, Murad Speaks, your hosts, Shamima Muhammad and Dr. Nadia Muhammad. Dr. Muhammad will not be with us today as she's working on community projects. We began with Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. I greet the listening audience in the peace of Assalamu alaikum. Today we are honored to have Margaret Johnson Hodge. She is the author of 19 published works, many receiving national acclaim and making multiple best-selling lists. She has garnered rave reviews from the likes of Publishers Weekly, USA Today, and Booklist, to name a few. She is the recipient of the Reviewer's Choice Award for her first novel, The Real Deal, and Author of the Year, nomination for her seventh work, A Journey to Here. And Midwest Book Review declared her ninth book, Red Light, Green Light, as a book so memorable it will become a classic in years to come. In fact, today we will speak about this specific work later in the show. Margaret novels have been considered by Showtime and Hallmark for book-to-movie options, and she's been published for over 30 years. She has guest authored at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire, with two of her tomes used as part of their English course curriculum. Harvard University invited Margaret to submit her story for their literary magazine. Originally from New York, Margaret continues to pay homage to that great city, with every story that she writes and gives highly successful writing workshops online throughout the year. Margaret grew up in Jamaica, Queens. We're going to begin, Margaret, with your inspiration for writing books. You explained your major inspiration began with your mother, Alma Adele Hinton Johnson, whom was referred to as Mother Johnson, and later to many of us as Mother Nana. If you would expound on this for our listening audience, and again, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, and assalamu alaikum, my sister. I am so happy and pleased to be on this show with you and sharing this time with you and talking about something I'm very passionate about, and that is writing. My mother was definitely my inspiration, and there's a saying that 2020 in hindsight often puts you off guard, because in retrospect, it says something that I recently realized. A mother is a mother. You have that whole mother-daughter dynamic, and your mom does what she does, and it's so big whoop and whatever, whatever. But I realized that from the beginning, she helped put the footpath for me to follow to become a writer. And the main way was that my mother was an avid reader. And as a result of my mother being an avid reader, my older sisters were avid readers. And me being the youngest, I saw everybody else, so I wanted to read too. And so I started reading at the age of four. Even though I didn't understand the words, I would just pick up whatever I could get my hands on. And then later on, I continued with my love of reading. And when I got through with whatever books that were age-appropriate for me, whatever my mama had on her nightstand, I was reading that too. She supported me in a sort of kind of quiet kind of way, if that makes sense. I started writing my first novel at 12, and though she never said anything, she never asked me what I was doing on that electric typewriter back in the late 60s. She never questioned what I was doing. Later on in life, when I went on to start my own publishing company, he was the first person to step up and support me. And in terms of her presence and her spirit, kindness and consideration to other people, I realized I took note of that. And many of my novels have a certain character in them that respects that type of personality. And she was proud of me, and she supported me, and she was happy that I became a writer. And so, yeah, in retrospect, my mother was always there for me in my pursuit of writing.
Mother Johnson was a woman of strong faith, and she had tremendous compassion for humankind. In fact, we shared many, many stories. And I remember her telling us one of her stories. When she would invite individuals battling addiction, and of course she knew these particular individuals, they grew up in a neighborhood, but she never forgot them. She would literally invite them to the kitchen table.
She would.
Can you explain the type of people she would invite and how you felt about that initially and then throughout the years?
Okay. We as a family, we would get together often. Any excuse to get together around the kitchen table and share a meal, we were there. And it was often to a place at my mother's home, which was the central place. So my sister and her husband and her kids would come over, and my other sister and her husband and their kids would come over, and we'd gather around the table. This particular time, I can't remember exactly what the occasion was, but someone that she knew had rang the doorbell. And this particular individual had been struggling with drug addiction for a very long time. And she invited him to our kitchen table. Now, we're all sitting around eating, laughing, having a good time. And in walks this African-American man, maybe in his 30s, 40s. You could tell by his dress, he was not clean. His clothes were dirty. His hair was uncombed. There was a smell about him, and you could tell that he literally hadn't had a bath in a very long time. You could tell, as we used to say, he was out there on the street. But despite that, my mother told him to come and sit at the table, and he came, and he sat at the table. Now, me and my sisters and my nieces and nephews, we all given him and my mother the side eye, because not only did he look bad, he smelled bad, he's trying to eat, he's bunking up the room. And I remember distinctly that even in his state of being out there, he knew exactly what he was presenting to us, and he felt embarrassed. And he really did not want to join us at the table. But my mother insisted, because she realized, and I something again in hindsight, that he needed to feel like he was still a part of community. And no doubt he needed a meal. And so he came, he sat, we gave looks, we snickered, we looked at each other. He ate, he finished his meal, he thanked my mother, he said goodbye to all of us, and he left out. And we didn't say a lot, because it was something that my mother had decided. But we talked about that for a very long time. And not in a good, like, wow, that was what mommy did. It was like, oh, my God, I can't believe she did that sort of thing. So it was just an example of the type of person that she was. If she saw a need, and if she could help fulfill that need, she was always right there.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. It's interesting you say that during this time, you know, the consciousness is like, oh, my mom did a wonderful thing. Years later, you're a mother of two, and you were supporting a local community organization in a soup kitchen. And I believe it was Thanksgiving, one of the holidays. And the homeless people were lined up to get a meal, to get a hot meal.
Yes.
And someone made a negative comment And you said no. You treated each and every individual with yes, sir, yes, ma'am. Can you explain that?
Okay, so for you. Yes, I belong to an organization, and there is another organization in next town over that has a homeless shelter system set up, and they provide hot meals for breakfast, hot meals for lunch, and they ask volunteers to come in to prepare either breakfast or lunch. And that particular day, the organization I was with, we were there to prepare, I think it was breakfast. And so we had a selection of food, and as people were coming in, I knew that the last place they wanted to be was at that soup kitchen. I know if they had a choice, they would have been in their own kitchen. So I didn't want to add any more. I didn't want to damper any more, put any more burden on them. So I decided that I was going to treat each person that came up there with dignity and respect. And you can hear my voice. It still upsets me. And so as people are coming up to get their food, I would say, you know, good morning, sir. Good morning, ma'am. Hi, sweetie. What would you like? Would you like this? Would you like that? Did I want some of this? You want some of that? And somebody made a comment. Why are you asking them what they want? They just got to take whatever we get them, give them. And I turned to them and I said, no. And that's all I said. Because if nothing else, we should be there to serve with some dignity. And I was just trying to give whoever showed up that morning at the food pantry some dignity. And there is no harm in saying, good morning, sir, good morning, ma'am. There's no harm in asking them, what would you like? Give them choice. We have more than enough food. Let them decide. Don't decide for them. Let them decide what they wanted to eat. And so that's what I did. But it bothered me. And, you know, years after the fact, you can hear my voice. It still upsets me. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that wonderful story. Your mother was a community activist and formed a community organization entitled Yates Road Block Association.
Yes.
In July of 1990, specifically July 15th, Newsday article featured a specific article on the Yates Road Block Association. And your mother shared this with me. It was so interesting. Oh, we have so many wonderful stories. Sitting at the table. And you know, Margaret, as you say, we just got together because.
Right.
So we were sitting at the table, and Mother Johnson was cutting up her cucumbers because she said, you have to eat something raw every day. I say, yes, Mother.
Yes.
And starting, she said, Salima. And it goes back, you know, before I start this story, I really want to speak about how remarkable she was. I'm going to come back to this remarkable story. But your mother went back to college at the age of 66. And majored in theology.
Yeah.
She graduated in 1991 from Divinity School. Mother studied Christianity, Islam, and Judaism. And when I first met her, she stated we were all one.
Yes.
She caught my attention, and we were friends throughout the rest of her life.
Yes.
She was one of my spiritual mothers.
Yeah.
So this particular day, we're sitting at the table. Mother Johnson is cutting up her greens and her cucumbers. And she has this beautiful tree out in front of her home that she modeled because the birds would come and tweet and sing, and it was beautiful. And we were looking up on the tree, and she was telling us about, my daughter and I were there, and she was telling us about the Yates Roadblock Association organization. So the article, July 15, 1990 news, they featured Mother Johnson and the imam. She said, I know the minister. She said, but she said, and Mother was, well, gosh, Mother was in her 80s during this time, right, Margaret?
Oh, yes, she was in her 80s.
She was in her 80s at this time. She
yeah.
said, but I can't remember the minister's name. I said, that's okay, Mother. She said, there's an article around here someplace. I said, that's okay, Mother. You and I spoke earlier this week, and you said, Salim, I have the article. I said, Margaret, you have the article. I said, send me the article. So 2 days ago, the imam was Askia Muhammad.
Yes.
And I'm saying in my mind, there's only one Askia Muhammad. And I look at the article, Askia Muhammad. Now, this is a true story to the listening audience. This is divine, and Margaret and I always experience divine magic, and it's just added to the list. I'm scared. This is a small world. Mother Johnson and Imam Askia Muhammad acted as a financier to reduce various community omens, crime, poverty, programs for the youth, etc. It's a true story.
Mm-hmm.
My cousin and I were part of the youth leadership at Mosque 25 in Newark, New Jersey. And our counter youth leadership in New York, Mosque number 7, was no other than Imam Askia Muhammad and his brother.
Mm.
Both youth grew up in the Nation of Islam and then grew and evolved in Al-Islam. And I think we were 15, 16, and my cousin and I were taking the train over to New York sometime, and Aski and his brothers would come over to North sometime to attend our programs, and we would attend workshops given by Dr. Naeem Akbar. And he was a psychologist in Al-Islam out of New York, and he would often speak and give workshops there. Is not this a small world, Margaret? If you would speak specifically about that Yates Block Association.
Okay. So Yates Road is literally one street in South Jamaica, Queens. It's literally one road. And we had moved there in, I think, 1969. And it was your working class neighborhood. And, you know, and though there were quite a few people in the area who were considered middle class, working class area. And so, unfortunately, like two blocks away around the corner, there was a strip of street called 150th Street. Now, I'm not sure exactly how it happened, but in the late 60s, middle 60s, it became sort of like a drug supermarket. And at the time, the drug was heroin. I know we had a lot of African-American brothers coming back from Vietnam hooked on heroin. And I'm sure that has something to do with why 150th Street was like the drug supermarket, and, you know, the police and politicians and everybody else looked the other way, and that was like two blocks from us. So there had been, you know, that drug traffic in the area. But overall, it was a pretty decent place to stay, and, you know, it was one block, and, you know, kids could run around and play, and they did. And soon after we moved there, my mother saw a need to do something for the community. So she started the Yates Roadblock Association, of which she was president. and she started bringing in programs for the children. She got permits to open up the fire hydrants in the summer, and she got out one street designated as a play street. So certain times during the day, the street would be blocked off, and the kids could play and jump rope and roller skate without cars coming in and out. We had block parties. She got the summer lunch program and summer breakfast program. She went on and she got permission and she operated a summer youth program where the teenagers in our neighborhood could have employment as summer counselors. So she was doing a lot for the block. We would plan trips to Hershey Park and Texas State Park, and we would do this, that, and the third, and have block parties. So she started that. She was able to bring a lot of things into the community for the community. And that was like in the early 70s. Well, in the late 70s, early 80s, crack cocaine hit. And it hit our neighborhood like a bomb. I witnessed it myself with my own eyes. I mean, young, bright, college-educated African-American women who get up in the morning and their three-piece suits and their briefcases and go off to work, suddenly they're standing online in the morning in their three-piece suits and their briefcases waiting to buy some crack cocaine before they went to work. You know, the winos that we affectionately looked upon on the corners, they were replaced by drug dealers and violence and crack prostitutes. And it got really, really sad. And I believe what happened is there was, you know, and kids would be young kids, teenagers out there with guns trying to shoot each other. And I never forget one night I was laying in bed. My son was asleep. My husband was asleep. And I heard gunshots. And pow, 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 pow. And I remember I snatched my young infant son out the crib and run to the living room and lay behind the couch to keep him safe. And around this time, bullet hole in my mother's living room wall. Because one of those gunfights, a bullet actually lodged inside the wall. And I think that was sort of like the catalyst for her to want to do something. And she had been dealing with, you know, a local precinct, 103rd precinct for decades. She had been dealing with community board 12 for decades. She had been trying to work with the politicians to get something done for decades, and they did little or nothing. And so it came to her to go around the corner to the mosque that was operated by Iman Asiya Muhammad and ask for his help to do something about the crime and the drugs in the neighborhood. Now, at that time, my mother was a full-fledged Christian woman, and she remained so, you know. PTL was her thing. PTL and Jimmy Swagger, straight, born-again Christian. And I don't know how many of you are familiar how it was back then, but one of the most, I think, important points about what my mother did was, back then, Christians were Christians, Muslims were Muslims, you know, as far as Christians were concerned, you know, the only true religion was Christianity. And anybody who didn't practice that, you know, was not really a God. It was this whole conundrum of, you ain't a Christian, that my mother even thought to do this. She stepped over the whole concept of what religion is because she saw need in the community, and she was seeking help. And no doubt the Holy Spirit guided her to reach out to the imam, and he responded in kind. And him and his members set up shop, and they started patrolling the neighborhood. They would start at sunset. They must have been 50 strong, decked out in black. Now, they didn't have any weapons on them, okay? All they had was their presence, their determination, their faith and their belief that they can make a change in the neighborhood. 50 strong in black, and they would start around the corner, and they would march from 154th Street up Yates Road. And then they would get to Yates Road and something, and they would take a right, and they would march down up to Fuller Park. And then when they get all the way down to Scott's over, and then they'd make another right, and they would do that. And then they would corner. And when I say that the gate was immediate, it got so peaceful, so quiet, so nice. It was surreal. People were sitting outside to get on their stoop. Children were running and playing after dark. It was a beautiful, wonderful day. And they did it with simply their presence. If they weren't happy with it, and they tried to send in different people to threaten the Imam, but the Imam and his followers were strong for the community. And it was a beautiful sight to see.
Marvin, thank you for sharing that extraordinary story. This is 1919. When I was a teen, we're talking late 70s, early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Askia saying he always wanted his own masjid. And to the listening audience, this is the unification that we're looking for today.
Yes.
And it's interesting how Mother Johnson herself evolved, because when I met her, she said, we are all one.
Yes.
So that experience was very cathartic for her. And I know personally, because I knew Askia, he was a martial artist, and I know his brothers, that there was at least almost 12 of them, I think. And they were all martial artists. So you said they came with no weapons.
No weapons. All they had was their presence in black. And Sister Salima, when they came around that corner, now I think they were saying something, and I don't know what they were saying, but before they even reached Yates Road, you could hear them coming because they were saying something. I don't know what they were chanting or saying, but you could hear them coming from around the corner. And when they appeared at the top of the block, my God, it was a sight to see.
Brothers and sisters, Allahu Akbar, Allah is the greatest, because God is the greatest. And what we can do when we have faith in him, what we can do, what I love about this story is what we can do collectively.
Yes.
How wonderful. Mother Johnson was how old when she transitioned, Margaret?
95 and a half.
I know because I always say 96. But you said, no, not quite.
Yeah, 95 and a half.
Oh, I tell you, she was a treasure.
Yes.
We're going to talk more about your works. I'm going to take a short pause and mention again, this show is brought to you by New Africa Excellent Mirage Inc. I want to briefly, before we begin talking about your works, your other inspiration. I know that happened to be your husband.
Oh, gosh, yes.
He too has transitioned. But I want the listening audience to hear this wonderful story about how you were a mother of two and you wanted to write full time.
Yes.
So you went to your husband, and I'm going to let you tell the rest of the story.
Okay. So, I very started when I was 12. I started my first book when I was 12, and that book became my very first published novel 28 years later when I was 40. So my writing journey had been long. So I had been writing since I was 12. by age 36, I still had no book contract. I had no agent. I just had the desire to write. I was still writing my story. I had a wonderful husband, two young boys, and a job that I had hated. And the reason why I hated my job, because my boss made my life miserable. Every single day that I showed up, it was like her plan was to see how miserable she could make my life. And so I would come home from work miserable, and my husband would see me miserable. And then a couple of times my husband would come up to the job, you know, to take me to lunch. And he, you know, and he could tell that he was not nice to me at all. And so this went on for about a year. And then one day he said, if you want to stay home and become a full-time writer and raise our children, you can. And my husband is of Caribbean background, okay, from Aruba. And such a thing was really unheard of. Everybody works. You have 7 million jobs. So when he said this to me, of course my answer was yes, yes. And I was just amazed because I didn't have a book contract. I didn't have a literary agent. I was just writing. I had nothing but my goals and my dream and my desire. And he believed in me enough so much that he said, I can stay home and become a full-time writer. Believe that I was just going to stay home because my husband said I could stay home. I said, well, my husband said I could stay home. I don't have to work no more, so I'm quit. I didn't tell her about becoming the writer part because I just didn't want, I just left it there. And she didn't believe it. She probably thought I was off to some other job. And my family was shocked and surprised, and his family was shocked and surprised, so that just was not heard of. But at the time, my husband had a very, very good job where he could take care of the household with his paycheck. And like I said, he saw my vision. He saw my hopes and dreams, and he supported me from the beginning. So that was in, like, 1994. And by 1996, we had moved to Georgia because he said New York was no place to raise young African-American boys. We moved to Georgia in 1996. He took a job that paid him one-third of what he was making in New York. He worked 3 jobs to support us. And that same year, I got my first book contract with St. Mark's because he believed in me enough to give me the freedom to invest full-time in what I was trying to be. And that was a published writer. So that's the story.
Thank you so much for sharing that beautiful story.
Yeah.
Story that's always in my heart.
Yeah.
I'm going to begin speaking about some of your works, and I picked this particular book because it speaks about the things that was going on in your community. Again, to the listening audience, Midwest Book Review declared her 9th work, Red Light, Green Light, as a book so memorable that will become a classic in years to come. It is already one of my classics. It's one of my favorite books of yours.
Thank you.
The premise of the book is about a crack addict named Craig Sweeters, I believe. It's the 9/11 backdrop. He had a sponsor who happened to be a Muslim. His name was Brother Raheem. Tell us more about the story, Margaret.
Okay, so I have a tendency to write. I write real life. I don't write about CEOs and presidents and princes, you know, and kings and queens. And I write about real life, everyday people. You know, the people that I see around. And so I've tackled different issues with different books. And the way Red Light, Green Light happened, truthfully, is I had a fellow author who had written a book called, I think it was called 6 Days in January. And I have to do the thing where I'm reading somebody else's work, and my mind jumps ahead to how the sentence is going to finish off. We had some sentence in this book, and I just thought this was going to finish off with Red Light, Green Light. The sentence didn't finish off with Red Light, Green Light, but that name, Red Light, Green Light, just stuck in my head. So I just sort of filed away in my brain, which I tend to do. I see stuff, it's filed away. And then one day it came back to me, Red Light, Green Light. And something said, well, that would make an interesting book. And I was like, yeah. And look, this is my process. And so I said, well, what is it about? And I was like, I don't know. And I said, well, let me do what I always do. So I sat down at my computer, opened up a document, I formatted the pages, I put in the title, Red Light, Green Light. And I said, what does that represent? I said, well, red is stop, green is go, yellow's in the middle is the pause. What is that? And then the idea of a crack addict came to mind. And I said, okay, how does that line up with the red light, green light? And somebody said, he has come out of rehab. So he's on the red light. Now, that's how the basis of the story happened. I was able to take that and recall living on Yates Road and how the crack epidemic literally exploded my neighborhood, blowing everything and everyone and all the rules and norms to smithereens, and incorporated into this character. I also had friends and family who got addicted to crack, and I was able to, and how behavioral changing and how just horrific this drug affected people. And I was able to incorporate that into the story. And that's how I came up. Be right, and I will say that I wrote for so this week that people who have known me all my life, or most of my life, or knew me really well, really thought that at some point in my life, I had got hooked on crack, and got hooked off of crack, got off of crack, and wrote the book. And I will share, I had a cousin who called me on the phone saying hello. She is screaming, hysterical, wanting to know if I'm okay. And I'm like, I didn't know who she was. Because she screamed for like 30 seconds. Are you okay? Are you okay? Oh, my God. Mother, are you okay? And finally I had to say, who's this? And she said, this is your cousin, blah, blah, blah. I was like, oh, my God. I said, I'm fine. What? She said, I just read your book, Red Light, Green Light. And I had to make sure you were okay. Because she thought from how I wrote the book, somewhere in my life, I had got hooked on crack, got off of crack, and wrote the book. And that's how authentic. That's how authentically I brought Craig's story to life in the book.
Yes, ma'am. Why the 9/11 backdrop?
Okay, that's interesting. I think because I wanted to explore internal struggles of dealing the physical struggle and the emotional struggle internally. And the mental struggle internally of dealing with addiction, and I wanted to take it to the ninth power by also bringing in external pressures. His world has literally exploded because of 9/11. The tower fell. The world came pressure down on him while he was dealing with his own internal struggle. I think that's why, because believe me, you know me, I write books, I don't know what I write them, I just put stuff on paper, and people tell me later. But in retrospect, I really think I wanted to explore his internal struggles and then had this external struggle upon him as well.
What were some of those internal struggles Craig experienced?
Well, you know, there's the physical struggle of the brain wanting, what is it, endorphins, that rush, that high. There is this whole muscle, I'm going to call it muscle memory of engaging in the act of focus. There's this whole emotional attachment to it. Again, going back to the act of engaging in the get high, right? And then there's the mental, that part of him that he never really successfully dealt with that drove him to the drugs, to mask it, so he wouldn't have to deal with it. So when you take away the drugs, there's all these different moving parts inside of him that he has to contend with. And he can't mask it. He has to deal with it. You know, it's physical discomfort, it's emotional discomfort, it's mental discomfort he has to deal with.
I agree. In fact, when I was reading the book, I enjoyed not liking his character.
Nobody liked him. Well, some people did. Most people did not.
The character, I enjoyed not liking him, and I thought it was so authentic.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, and I saw him, like you said, masking. I saw him escaping his true feelings, and I thought he was rather selfish, rather consistently in the book.
That's one of those things where I was not aware of. I wrote the story, but it wasn't until you pointed that out to me that he was selfish. I was like, you know what? Salima, right. He was selfish. But I didn't know. I wrote the book. I just write stories. I don't know.
And that's so interesting because there was so many challenging types of feedback with this particular work. How challenging was this work for you? And let's talk about the feedback, both positive and negative.
Okay, so
aside your cousin.
Okay, yeah. So again, I normally like to write about what I've seen. So I will preface again by saying I've never done crack. I'll never do crack. Don't want to do crack. I don't do drugs. I knew that I had to get into what it felt like to be on the hunt, what it felt like to be on the case, what it felt like to have $2 in your pocket, but you need $3 more so you can get your get high. What did that feel like? What did that do to the body? How did it make you feel and think? So the close how I feel in the morning before I have my coffee, okay? In the morning, I ain't have my coffee. Don't talk to me. Don't look at me. Nothing. I need my coffee. Get out of my face. So I just took that, and I just, like, expanded it, like, a gazillion times. So that was kind of challenging to try to bring in a thought, authentic experience to the pages, not having actually experienced that. That was challenging, but I guess I succeeded because at the end of the day, there's two groups of people. There are people who love the book. They loved it. They loved it. Oh, my God. You know, even Midwest Book Review said it's going to become a classic. And then there were other people who hated the book, hated it. My book editor hated the book. One of my beta readers hated the book. And the reason why the people hated the book is because either they helped dealt with addiction themselves and it brought up too many memories, or they had been in a relationship with someone or knew was close to someone who had dealt with addiction, and it stirred up them that they didn't want to deal with. So that was the camp. They either really loved it or they really hated it. And that just made me know that I had done my job because I always want to write a story where people feel something. It's okay to hate my work. That means I did my job. That means I made you feel something that you may not necessarily want to feel, but I made you feel. So that was a chance. Yeah.
Yes. I think you went to one of the neighborhood barbershops that gentleman later became a council person in the town in which you lived. Tell me, what was the reaction based on your readings in that population?
It was quiet. It was very quiet. Small. Other people looked uncomfortable. I didn't sell many books, but I knew at the end they had heard my words. And again, it was those two camps. There were some people in there who really liked it, and there were other people in there who didn't like it at all. It made them uncomfortable.
And that's what I love. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was also going to say, nobody asked me any questions, but I could see almost two camps already. And I'm, you know, nope. Don't give me the barbershop owner. I think he's flat back. So, but everybody else is sort of looking. You know, some look shell-shocked, some look enthralled.
And that's what I love about you personally. As an author, we discussed many times reaching that grassroots audience and you being able to go in the neighborhood to distribute your works, I think, is monumental.
Thank you.
Because it gets it to the people who you live everyday lives with. So you brought along that same format from New York to Georgia.
Yeah.
I remember when we first moved this next door to one another, your husband, Terry, and yourself rang our doorbell, and you introduced yourself. And I thought, my God, who does that today? How genuine. And we became friends, and you and Terry had two sons, and I had my little Samaya.
Yes.
And her, Mr. Terry, became the best of friends.
Yes. Yes.
And she didn't leave until adulthood. And I mentioned this because there was yet another phase you went through, and take your time, because I want the listening audience to hear this story.
Okay.
Margaret,
yeah.
At this point in your life, you decided to self-publish.
Yes, I did.
Please explain that process.
Okay.
Most importantly, let me get this. And most importantly, why this process began for you?
Okay. All right. So, started writing was when I was 12. I got my first book contract at 40, and I was just so thrilled to be a published author with a major publishing company in New York, St. Martin's Press. Yes. They published my first book, A New Day, I mean The Real Deal. Then that was in 1998. And then in 1999, they published my second book, A New Day. And that book, the second book, A New Day, which dealt with learning how to embrace that single mother. Despite your struggles, you deserve the best in life. You're worthy, and you deserve the best in life, and it's okay to want that. That was my second book, A New Day. That put me to national best-selling status, okay? And then they published my third book in 2000, Warm Hands, okay? And then the same year, they published the fourth book, Buttershot Blues, which dealt with HIV and AIDS and how it affects relationships. So mind you, my first book that I got published with them, they put it out in paperback. I don't know. I'm happy to be published. Okay, yes. My second book, A New Day, they put out in paperback. Again, I was like, okay, you know, that's fine. They gave me a little more money. My third, now, when A New Day put me at national best-selling status, and my publisher never, so technically, if I made national best-selling status, which back in those days meant I sold over 12,000 copies of the book, then it would be okay to, like, up the ante. So for my third book, technically, they should have took me from mass market paperback, at least the trade paperback, but they didn't. So they released my third book and still mass market paperback, okay? Now I'm national best-selling author. I don't know. They ain't told me. And I didn't know that until my third book came out and it said on the cover, national best-selling author. I was like, oh, I'm a national best-selling author? Nobody told me. Wow. Okay, so now we're at the fourth book, Butterscotch Blues. Now, I have done three books with them, reached national best-selling status. They've been putting my books out in still tiny little bizarre fucking paper. Something said, and I'm just going to call it spirit. My mama would call it the Holy Spirit, said, this fourth book, they need to put this fourth book in hardcover. Okay? I want my fourth book in hardcover. I'm national best-selling. My sales are good. This is my fourth book with you. I want it in hardcover. They didn't want to do it. They were like, no, we're not ready, whatever, whatever. And I believe I just put my foot down. Okay? Now, they couldn't really do anything because the contract was signed, okay, for the book. So I didn't have to give them back the money because technically I had completed my obligation. I did the book was ready to go to print. So I forced them to put my fourth book in hardcover. Now, back in those days, this was in the late 90s, there were a lot of writers out there, and I was considered a romance writer, even though I wasn't. And romance writers did not get hardcovers. It was just unheard of. You know, Terry McMillan got hardcovers, you know, and all the white main authors got hardcovers. But folks like me didn't get hardcovers. It was unheard of, but I put my foot down. And so they did. They released the book in hardcover. That book went on to make the Essence bestsellers list and the Blackboard bestsellers list, Mosaic Magazine bestsellers list, Black Expression bestsellers list. It was highlighted in USA Today as Summer Read Pick of 2000. Dallas Morning Star, it was highlighted. So that book not only got attention, but it made a lot of bestsellers lists, okay? But the publisher put it out in hardcover begrudgingly. So now, okay, I've tried to negotiate my fifth book, okay? Now, I have four books with them, won all these bestsellers lists, this award, that award, USA Today, and it's time to negotiate for my fifth book. Well, they didn't want to pay me any real money. By my fifth book, I realized a couple of things. I realized that my sales, what they reported that how many books I sold, was full of fuzzy math. I found out about the world of reserves, returns, and I call it reserves, returns, and royalties. And that's a whole another discussion. But it's, you know, the publishing industry is sort of set up like the record industry. And I don't know how many of you heard the story about Pharrell, his song Happy. Pharrell's song Happy was downloaded millions of times. Millions of times people downloaded Happy. And his payment for all those millions of downloads was about $4,000. Okay? So if you figure whoever was getting at least a dollar for every time someone downloaded that song made millions. Pharrell ended up with $4,000. So I'll just say that the publishing industry is like the music industry. Runs along those same lines. They didn't want to pay me no money. I said, you know what? I am not going to accept that. That's not enough money. My agent at the time said, oh, it's a good deal, blah, 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 which caused me to give her a side eye. I was like, if she thinks that's a good deal, she doesn't need to be my literary agent. So I left Damon's press, and I left my agent. All my writer friends thought I was nuts. They were like, you left St. Martin's Press? What, are you crazy? You dropped your agent? Are you crazy? And I knew I wasn't crazy. And I didn't know what, when, how I would ever publish another book. But at that point, I got a strong, clear vision of what I was for. And I knew I would never let anybody else determine what my worth was again. Because had I taken that deal, I would have never paid. They would have never paid me my worth. So I walked away. So I had no agent, had no publishing house, I had no contract. I just had my words on paper. And eventually, for 18 months, I was out there with nothing but my word on paper. And eventually I was able to connect another agent who saw my work. And that agent took my book, not only didn't want to publish, but didn't want to pay me no money for, and she took my book out there, and I ended up with a bidding war. Five main publishers wanted my fifth book some Sunday, five. And it was exciting because phone would be ringing off the hook, it would be my agent. So-and-so called, so-and-so called, so-and-so interested, so-and-so want to pay you this, so-and-so. And it was like five mainstream publishers wanted my fifth book. So I went from Damon's Press wanting to pay me 2 cents to a bidding war. Now, had I not, and I have to give all credit to God, because God put it in my heart to walk away. But had I not walked away, I would have still been at St. Martin's Press making 2 cents. But I walked away, stepping out on stage, and that stage led me to a six-figure book deal, a total of 79 city book tours spread out over 3 books, where I would fly with town cars, and so you can attest to this,
yes,
town cars would come pick me up from my home, drive me to the airport, I'd get on a plane, fly to Colorado, Chicago, or Texas, New York, here, there, yonder, at the airport, an escort would meet me, often with a sign, and they would take to the hotel, and then they would come back and pick me up and take me to all the different little book signings I had. Next day, they would take me back to the airport. I'd get on another plane and go to the other city, ordering room service, you know, doing a little TV, you know, a local TV station interviews. So I went from 2 cents to that. To that. Six figures, 79 city tour, flying all over the country, being picked up in town cars, having an escort take me around to a venue. And trust me, I had other author friends who did not get that. I had other author friends at that same publishing house who did not get that. They had to get to the airport on their own. They had to pay for their own hotels and be reimbursed. They had to call cabs to get them around. So I went from that to this, and life was wonderful. So I released 3 books with Kensington Publishing, which was Some Sunday, Two Lies, and A Journey to Here. Okay? Unfortunately, when I released my first book, Some Sunday, on September, my very first tour, stop on that tour, was New York City, Borders 28th, 2001. That was my first stop. 28 cities, that was my very first stop. New York City, Borders, Twin Towers, September 28, 2001. Well, as you all know, on September 11, 2001, the towers were no more. They were gone. It was gone. It was gone. The bookstore was gone. And I did not know what was going on with the world. And I had a husband and two young sons, and I had to cancel my tour because I did not know what was going on in the world, and I was not going to venture far from home. And my publisher didn't like that, but they had no choice but to accept it because they didn't want to cancel the tour. And I had to threaten them. Well, I'm not going to say threaten. I had to just be firm. I was like, look, either you cancel the tour or I will write a letter to every single person that is on this 28-city tour. I said, believe me, I will do it. Which would have looked bad on the publisher if I had done that. So they relented, and so my first 28-city tour was canceled, and I just did local stuff. I did go to Alabama and Georgia, and that was kind of it. So anyway, moving on. So I'm at the end. I finished my the third book's about to come out. It's time to renegotiate. So that lovely six-figure book deal that the publisher had offered me initially years ago, they reduced it real low. So once again, I'm with the mainstream publisher, selling. I'm making bestsellers list. They don't want to pay me no money. And I had my eighth book ready. It was a sequel to the highly successful True Lies. And they wanted the book, but they didn't want to pay me no money. And again, Holy Spirit put in my heart, said, no. If you give them that book, it's going to be the same situation you walked away from that same monster. Holy Spirit said, if you're going to give the book to anyone, give it to yourself. And I haven't looked back. And then that time I went on to publish 7 of my own bodies of work under my name. And that's my story.
Thank you for that amazing story. Margaret, if you would tell us, you know, just for the listening audience, briefly, the monetary scale is different for the hardcover than it is for the paperback. If you could just touch on that with a little example. And then, most importantly, you own your own works.
Yes. I got all my works back.
So speak about the difference between the hardback and why that's such a big deal versus the paperback, and give us a monetary example if you can. And then let's talk about how you got your work back. You know, how to maintain your work back. This is very important.
Okay. So I'm going to go back. I'm just going to use an example. You know, paperbacks, the little paperbacks you see in the store, they fit in your pocketbook, and they normally sell for back then they were like $6.99. Okay? Now, the cover price is $6.99. As a author, you only get a percentage of that cover price. Normally, the royalty rate for a paperback is 99. As an author, you're going to make 58 cents. Okay? So every time you sell a book, you know, people buy it for $6.99, and you get paid 58 cents. Okay? Hardcover. Hardcover books, let's say $23.99. Rate for hardcover, you have to sell a certain amount of copies before you get to 10% of the royalty. So you start out normally at 8.825%. Okay? So in the store, people pay $23.99 for that book. As an author, you make $1.99.
Wow.
$1.98. Now, people who buy the book will pay $23.99, but you're going to start out as the author receiving $1.98. Signed in hardcover, because it's better to make $1.98 for every book you sell as opposed to 58 cents for every book you sell.
And then what is that difference when you self-publish?
When you self-publish, if you sell your book for $23.99, when somebody buys the book, they get their $23.99 immediately.
Amen. That's what I want to make. This is the point I wanted to make here.
Yeah.
Briefly explain how you pay your own works back.
Okay. So you sign a contract, and this is what, and I'm hoping I got some wannabe published or writers out there who one day will sign a contract. This is very important. It needs to be stated in your writing contract with any publisher the term limits on the right for them to publish. There are so many writers out there who did not have an agent, who did not make sure that was in the contract, and the publisher will own the rights to their book forever and a day. My agent, and I'm grateful to both of them, made sure that my contract stated that the publishers could only print my book for a certain amount of time. After that time, which is like was like 7 years, I had the right to request my rights back, and that's what I did. I had to get an attorney, a high-powered New York attorney, at the one publishing house because they were playing dumb. I was sending letters, you know, by mail. I want my rights back to this book, that book. And they were ignoring them. I was sending a little green card, you know, saying that somebody received the letter. I was never getting the green card back. The letters would just disappear in the thin air, tracking to it and finding the post office. They were just, like, ignoring me, like, fool, go away. Well, I got what was then at the time, one of my high-powered attorney after this. She wrote one letter. That's all it took. And my rights came back to me this week. And what does that mean? I got my rights back. That means that every single book that I published with 10 to 10 in St. Martin's Press, I now, this issue, which I have done, I hope to do, I could do Broadway plays. They are my rights. When Hollywood comes calling to make my books into movies, they got to negotiate with me and my attorney, of course. But I own the rights to that. And like I said, I have author friends right now. I have a friend right now. Book is out 20 years, and they just did a reissue. And I don't think there's anything in the contract, her contract, that says that she can get her book back. So she'll be, he may be dead and gone, and they'll still be publishing her book, and they'll still be making money. But I got that for all the rights. I own all mine. Yes.
That is
so,
a blessing. I tell you, Mother, this is so key, and I know we have some inspired writers out there, and this is very important. Again, term limits regarding your contract, and we'll have you back on again. This is wonderful. You have 19 works. Briefly talk about writing workshops, because you give them, and what I love, Margaret, you give free workshops, and you also give paid workshops, including more of this specific how to self-publish, and you also talk about writing itself. Can you talk about that briefly?
Yeah. Again, I'm going to have to give honor to my father on this. I never thought I would be a writing workshop instructor. I never thought I'd be giving writing workshops. I was just a writer, and that's all I did. Many, many years ago, I'm going to say like 2006, I was working with my mother at our church at the Cajun Bible study. She came to me, and she said, "You should do a little writing workshop for the kids at the church." And, yeah, I gave my mama the side eye because, you know, that's how I used to my mama say stuff. I just have to get a side eye. Like, what's she talking about? I was like, yeah, I didn't know how to get it. She was like, yeah, just make it something really simple, not long. And so I did. And the kids loved it. And Salima, I don't know. I think you in there somewhere, girl. I don't remember.
How I am. I was the other person who said,
yeah,
workshop to the children. You were like,
Yeah. And I was like, where, how, what? And then I believe you mentioned the live family, and I was like, girl, they don't even like me there. They ain't got my book there. But I tried, and I started giving workshops for free at my local library. And it ran about 3 hours long, and anybody who wanted to participate would come in. And I would just give them some basics of writing, some fundamentals, some writing tips and tools and tricks how to be a better writer, and they get a chance to hear what they wrote. And, you know, I did it for the adults, children there. I prefer the adults, so children are tough. Children want to know where to snack. I didn't know I was supposed to bring snacks. Because, you know, I do a survey at the end of the workshop, and everybody wants to know, there was no snack. Where the snack? I didn't know. So it was a learning process, and I started to get doing at the libraries, and then, I think you were in here, and you were saying you need, and then I started doing little small paid ones around Kennesaw, and in my home, and at my clubhouse, and I think, Salima, you were the one that said I needed to expand it, something. And then I went to this event off of Marietta Square in Marietta, and I saw this wonderful space, and I started giving a whole day workshop from, like, 9 in the morning to, like, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And it was different things we did. You know, like, we'd be in the space, and then we go out to the local museum and we do work, you know, exercises there, and then we go to the square and get ice cream and come back. And it turned into this really wonderful thing, and I got high marks. My average rating for my workshop is 96% out of 100 doing that. And then I did one for the Georgia's Writers Association. I did one for them, and it was the highest rated event they ever had. And so I would start doing the workshop for my local library and then the library and another in Mapleton, and that was quite successful. And I was planning to do two this year, one in March and one in April, and then COVID-19 happened. And so there were people who wanted to come to the workshop, and they still wanted to do the workshop. And people have been asking me for years, can you do it online? Can you do it virtual? And, you know, I could be such an artist. I was like, no, I must be in the space with you. I have to see you. You got to share the same space, the space and this, that. And I cannot possibly. Anyway, I figured out a way to do it online. And so I did one in April, and I had posted it on Facebook and social media, free, online. I expected to do one workshop. I ended up doing 6. And so it's a free online workshop. I'm doing another set of series this year starting in October. And if anybody is interested, it's open to anyone. If anyone is interested in a listening audience who would like to take the workshop, it's online, it's on Zoom, it's free, it's fun. You learn a lot, laugh a lot, no pressure. They go to my website, which is mjhodge.net. Again, you can go to my website, which is M as in Margaret, J as in Johnson, H as in Harry, O as in Out, D as in David, G as in George, E as in Edward.net. Find out about my workshop. You can also find out about my book. The only thing you have to do is you just send me an email, and I'll put you on a notification list. And then when I have it set up, I'll send out a notice to you, you know, and we just take it from there. But, I never thought I'd be doing writing workshops, but here I am doing writing workshops, and I love it. I've had 8 of my writing students in the last 3 years go from my writing workshop to get their works published, which I'm really pleased about. And I do one-on-one. I help guide people if they want to self-publish. I take them from all the steps they have to go through to get their book self-published. They're up into finding printers and, you know, all that stuff. And if people want to try and get a mainstream publishing contract, I guide them on all the steps they need to do to make that happen. I also do manuscript rewritten something and want, you know, professional eye. I provide that. I provide a ton of writing services. And I, in many ways, I'm going to thank my mama. Thank you, mama, because she was the one that started me really on that part of my writing journey.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much for being with us. Margaret, if you would go ahead and give the email that the listening audience can contact you. Is that information on your website as well?
Yeah, there's a link on there that says contact me. And if not, I can give the email as well. It's like my website, MJ Hodge, no S, so it's M. J, H as in Harry, O as in Out, D as in David, G as in George, E, Bell, South, .net.
Thank you so much. It has been a true blessing.
Thank you.
I cannot wait until you're back again. We have so 19 works. We have work to do, my friend.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Stay on with me.
Okay.
I'm going to close. I want to extend blessings to those that have passed before us. May Almighty God, Allah, grant them Jannah, which is heaven. I thank you for sharing your wonderful, wonderful story. And to the listening audience, if you have questions for your host, I'm Salima Muhammad, and my email is sam, A-L, as in Larry, I-M-A-H, M-O-H, 77, at gmail.com. Again, that's Salima, S-A-L-I-M-A-H, M-O-H, 77, at gmail.com. Also, as I close, my message, if you take 5 steps, Almighty God will grant you 10.
Mm-hmm.
Believe in yourself. We've had so many beautiful examples from Margaret Johnson Hodge today. Note them, believe in your works, get excited about them, and start writing. To the listening audience, Miraj Muhammad will follow his segment after this program. Please stay tuned. And again, thank you for joining.
Assalamu alaikum, my brothers and sisters. I chose the 5 minutes to acknowledge and allow you to understand that what you just heard is what our platform is all about. That young lady explained it very well in how they control our destiny. And the only reason why they can control our destiny is because we are individuals. No one respects an individual. But for her to keep going and to create her own publishing company is what we all need to do. More important, to get behind that company. Now, this family that I introduced to you, the Muhammads, and you see there their mother and their father, who I know very well, these are men and women are very educated and very sound, and understand the present and the future. And this is why I'm trying to get you all to come from behind that door, because everyone has a gift and don't know it. But if we keep these gifts amongst ourselves, no one can control us. And I'm going to leave you with this. Now, I did over 1,000 programs on ABC, NBC, CBS, USA, Showtime, Pay-Per-View, Closed Circuit, ESPN, USA Today. I own all my rights exclusively. And I've had at least 15 of the best publish my book. In my nature, I couldn't allow them to do it. Am I writing my book today? Yes. Am I going to tell my story? Yes. But the great Booker T, the Honorable Booker T. Washington, son, great-grandson, is my engineer. But more important, he's a writer. More important, he has his own publishing company. I chose him because this way we will own our destiny. This way we can give it back. But not least, they have a brother that creates apps. I've been asking him to call me because you should be able to go to our apps and hear a young lady like that to teach you what she's been through you should not have to go through. What I've been through you should not have to go, and 1,000 more of us. This will save a lot of time and we'll benefit financially, morally, and be able to leave a legacy behind for our loved ones, God willing. I just had to take time out to do so, to say tune in next Saturday, and the Muhammad sisters will be able to bring you knowledge that we don't have, and that is the problem today. Communication. Communication is not a luxury, it's a necessity. And they have taken the communication away from us. Blog Talk Radio, New Africa, is our communication today. Conference call is our communication today. But if we speak in another language, we'll lose them in plain. Excellent show. And may God be with them, and God willing, we will hear them once again next Saturday. But Salima is my assistant, so tune in. Tune in on Tuesday, and you will hear her again. May God be with you, Murad Muhammad. Thank you. Be safe.